Wow, this one kind of came out of left field, didn't it? Yes, it did. Well, every once in a while, you just got to hear a little Nancy Sinatra in that great Bond film, You Only Live Twice. I saw a photograph of Sean Connery. He's 82, and he was in New York, and he looks like a very wise Mr. Bond at this point. And you know, I was wondering, I thought, say, what about Hackman? What's going on with Gene Hackman? I haven't seen anything out of him for a while. Mr. Hackman is now 83. May both of them be blessed. They produce some good art and some great entertainment, and they are now permanent fixtures in motion picture history. Okay, well, we got a full bank of calls here, and we'll get right to them. Let's take our quick little floating break and carry on conversations with you and our conversation, a most singular conversation, with Dr. Stephen Pachenik on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. You know, it's my fault because I talk, sometimes some people say too much. And frequently our guests have large thoughts and they need to be expressed. But I'll tell you what, we're going to get as many of your calls in as we possibly can with Dr. Steve Pachenik right now. Let's go to wildcard line number 3, Sharon in Springfield, Mo. How are you, Sharon? Thanks for calling. Thanks for holding. What's up?
Hello, Mr. Wells and Dr. Pachenik. I alternate between cold, rage, and nausea with what's going on in this country. I love America. But I feel like I need to vomit up a boulder-sized chunk of garbage all the time now.
That's a frightening visual, Sharon.
Yes, well, it's a frightening feeling.
Yes.
I have a question, Dr. Pachenik. Could you please tell me your opinion of the Oklahoma City bombing?
I have to be very frank. I know very little about the Oklahoma bombing and McVeigh. I know what many people say, but I really don't know very much about it. My expertise was in foreign affairs and international terrorism, so I really can't answer you very intelligently.
Feel free to hold that long, Sharon, without getting the answer to your question, but if you have another one, we'll entertain that one.
Okay. I have asked this question on other shows. When was the last time that anyone has heard anyone in this administration take responsibility for anything? When was the last time you have heard anyone in the Congress take responsibility for anything?
Well, it's been a while, Sharon. The last time in my memory would be Richard Nixon, when I think 3 of the 5 articles of impeachment had been pretty much given a green light, and he went ahead and resigned, so no impeachment was necessary. But that's the last time I can remember any government official taking responsibility for anything. What do you think, Steve?
I agree with you. I think that's a sad commentary, but it's true. I was in the Nixon administration, but the impeachment process was the last time of accountability. We haven't had it. I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, well, even Mr. Nixon, he decided to, you remember the 60 election was, he decided not to contest it in the interest of the country.
Well, you know, one of the things I think our listeners and your listeners really have to begin to understand is that it's true. Many things do not seem very good. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly. But you have to remember that we're a young country relative to the world. We're only 200 to 300 years old as an experiment in democracy. And we've done really quite well, despite the fact that we've had leaders who've lied, who've deceived, some who, despite their own insecurities and infirmities, have really allowed us to progress. And the truth of the matter is, the government is not the key issue in the United States. What is the key issue is really the individual and the entrepreneurs and the things that we as individuals do for ourselves. So the small businessman, it's not Wall Street that will determine the outcome. It's the small businesses. And small meaning anything that's legally below 500 million, although it sounds like a lot, that's the real determinant of the outcome of this nation. I have more hope than most people, only because I see all kinds of constructions going around me. There are constructions underneath the ocean, above the ocean, on roads. I see young people developing new companies. I see all kinds of ideas being developed and then discarded. I hear, you know, George Nouri. I hear Alex Jones. So, you know, on the one hand, it sounds terrible and things appear worse than they are. But quite frankly, the nature of our democracy is really centered around the notion that we have to fight for that. It's not given to us. Thomas Jefferson made it very clear many, many centuries ago that each generation must fight for their own democracy. It doesn't mean we have to go into the field and use guns. It means that we do have to question the authority of the state. There's an inherent tension between government and its citizens. We have a social contract. The government has become too big, too out of control. So in turn, what you're seeing now is the struggle of the people saying to the government, no, you cannot continue. You cannot grow at the expense of our own welfare. I find this to be very healthy. The truth of the matter is, if we did not have resistance and we did not have the struggle, I would find that very unhealthy. For example, take China in reverse. You know, it's called a communist country and all that. Their biggest problem is far, far greater than you can imagine. It's two issues that we're not concerned about. One is water. China has no water west of the Yangtze River, and that's a 500 million people that are bereft of water. And the second issue for China is control, social stability. We don't have that issue because no government, no matter how big you think it is, can control a country which literally has more rivers and more land beneath it than anyone can imagine. It takes us 10 days by car, night and day, to go to the east or the west coast. So I'm far more optimistic about our nation and where we're headed than I am about Europe, China, Africa, or the Central Asian republics, because we're continuing to grow. Europe is not. It's falling apart. No matter what you see and what you think, Germany and France still fighting it out over the euro. Russia has become an oligarchy and the return of a czar. Turkey becoming the predominant power. You have the Shiites and Sunnis fighting in the Middle East no matter what is said to you. We have no interest there. We have no interest in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have no need for 733 bases in 220 countries. So we're going to downsize our military. We're going to take away their armaments. We're going to take away the military-industrial complex, which holds each one of our congressmen hostage to their whims and ways. I mean, we don't need to build M1 Abrams anymore, the tanks. And so a senator like Portman can't get away with building M1 Abrams tanks when, in fact, the Defense Department says we don't need tanks. So the system needs to struggle. It needs to argue within itself. I find this helpful. And that's what our founding fathers were all about. They didn't agree with each other. But throughout our generations, we've always had a fight between the states' rights, federalism, the citizen, the rural versus the urban, and sure, so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
So I see optimism here.
You know, that's excellent because that's what everybody wants. We want a resolution, but you know what? I think we don't mind a good fight. And not necessarily, I'm not talking guns and knives here, but I mean, engage and be motivated to want to engage, not to just sit there. Hey, guys, I want all the guys to hold their position there, but ladies first. Let's talk to Diane. She's in Santa Barbara, California. So welcome, and thanks for calling.
Hello, John. Hi, doctor.
Hey.
Oh, my gosh, doctor. I think I could talk to you for hours because you're so, I'm just a all over the Obama's history, and it sounds like you were very involved with the government right about the time when he was working for Business International Corporation and with Brett Brzezinski and all those guys. And I think my theory, and I want to see if you agree, that he made his trip to Pakistan as a special rapporteur for the UN, and also the fact that Business International Corporation wrote a book, which I actually bought, it's 1968, the UN and the business world. And it's incredibly, I mean, I have that thing, you know, ear, or what do you call it, dog-eared all the way through. But it's a fascinating book, but I was just wondering if you have any insight on that.
Well, let me just clarify 2 points. Number one, it's no secret. You can look up his mother's involvement in the CIA. She was recruited to be a CIA in Indonesia. She spoke Indonesian. She spoke Russian. She was not just a hippie. His maternal grandmother was a banker in actually one of my regional areas, which is the Hawaii East-West Center, which is a CIA funding site. And his maternal grandfather, who fought in World War II, was in the CIA. He worked for Peter Geithner at the International Business Council, the Asian Business Council, which you talked about, which is a CIA cutout. Peter Geithner, Tim Geithner's father, was a CIA operative. That's not a secret. And then Obama went to Occidental College, which is totally plastered with ex-CIA operatives and who are now professors. You can look it up. It's in Los Angeles, not far from you. So it's not something that's amazing. It's just amazing that he never disclosed any of this, and the fact that he's not proud of his own mother, when in fact the distraction was he was talking about his father in Kenya, which was really not the issue. The issue was, why haven't you talked about the fact that you were born and bred of the Central Intelligence Agency? It's not something you'd necessarily be ashamed of. Why aren't you talking about the fact that you worked in Pakistan and elsewhere for Peter Geithner? And, you know, you don't negate your own history and make it exclusive and say to people and talk about transparency. That's what I talk about, John, that you brought out about. Well, where's the inconsistency in the narrative? Well, the inconsistency is when you talk about transparency and you don't want to reveal anything about your background, forget where you're born or anything like that, but what you studied, and you want to classify the fact that you went to Occidental, you may not have gone to Occidental, and then you went to Harvard, but that's the only thing we know about, but we don't know about your travels. That's inconsistent. When you talk to me about, you know, I care about democracy and I care about freedom and all, and then we have the most repressive rules that have come in terms of monitoring our own freedoms and information, and you find out that they're really piercing the corporate umbrellas in terms of secrecy and piercing into the IRS, through the IRS, into various conservative organizations, then you say, wow, this man is totally inconsistent with what he says in terms of his narrative. Therefore, we have to assume he's a liar. If he lied once about Osama bin Laden, he's going to lie again and again and again. And sure, you don't have to be a psychiatrist to say that. That was true of all our presidents.
Thanks, Diane. Steve, let me ask you something. Sure. Finish that thought, then I got a question for you.
Sure.
No, go ahead and finish your thought.
My point is that the American public has to awaken to the narratives that are being told to it. And it's not a question of saying, oh, well, that's nice. It's a question of saying, well, what does that really mean? And how is it that if you give me a narrative A, how come there's an inconsistency? And that's all you really have to begin to do. Begin to question the people of authority, even me or John or George, whoever it may be, and you find out within one or two questions, as you would in any business interview, you know, where have you worked? What exactly did you do? What is your background? When you find out, well, Obama hasn't had a very extensive background of any working, neither was Bush Jr., neither was Clinton, you say to yourself, well, these are all political animals, one out of Arkansas, the other one so-called out of Texas, and the third one out of wherever he came from, and you're saying to yourself, well, if politics is the only thing you know, then you haven't really run anything. You haven't been accountable for any business affairs. You haven't been accountable for people, so you don't really know how to manage. That was not a very difficult observation to make of the three presidents, or many of our presidents. So,
well, you know, and it seems to me, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it seems that the people are concentrating more on expending their energy opposing those that they perceive to be ideologically opposed to them, when we're actually all in the same boat and we're really not focusing on who our leaders are, because we have our bent, whatever it is, and then And then we have the dog and pony show up there that keeps us distracted. It's like we want to roll with this program. This sounds really good. And anyone who opposes what appears to be a good thing, anyone who says, you know, I'm not so sure about this, well, then all of a sudden now they're the target of the research rather than the government authority. You mentioned Los Angeles. Let's talk to Charles very quickly. Charles on wildcard line number two.
I wanted to ask Steve, in December of 2001, after the Trade Center fiasco, our Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, announced that Osama bin Laden had died of kidney failure. Would you comment on that?
Yes, she was correct. Osama bin Laden had already died because he had Marfan syndrome, M-A-R-F-A-N, if you look it up in Wikipedia. You will see that Marfan syndrome is a disease which affects the arteries, including the kidneys specifically. It affects the long bones. You have a very long jaw malocclusion. You can look at Abraham Lincoln. He had that. And you have a very short lifespan. Basically, renal disease will come and terminate your life. And he had renal dialysis machine. It was not an accident that El-Zawahiri, his number two man, so-called terrorist as well, was a physician and still is an MD. And matter of fact, as a footnote, most of the terrorists that I dealt with overseas in the Middle East and elsewhere are physicians and doctors, MD. George Habash, Bashir Assad of Syria is an ophthalmologist. The people in Iraq are neurologists. And so contrary to what we have in the United States, where we have lawyers dominating our system, medical doctors have far more prominence in the world, third world, and are really use terror as a technique than most others. And by the way, I think the audience should understand, the use of terror is 96 to 98% effective. That is, when you create a point of terror in the world, whether it's by an explosion, an IED, or psychological, it's very effective. It's intended to create fear. It's not intended to go to war, destroy a building. It's intended to create fear. So fear was created in 9/11 sufficiently enough to go to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So who did we kill last year?
Last year we killed nobody.
Well, the Osama bin Laden event, you mean that didn't happen?
That was a narrative. No, that was a false narrative that was created by Admiral Mullen and Special Forces Chief McRaven and Jose Gonzalez, where the CIA created this incredibly false narrative of a man who was found 10 years later who already had died of kidney failure, Marfan syndrome, and then they had to explain. The narrative went dead when, in fact, they tried to explain to everybody that Osama bin Laden was buried in the sea, which was absurd, and his body was cut up, and then his pieces were taken to Walter Reed. So the narrative fell apart, and the narrative fell apart because people like I predicted 10 years beforehand, and Madeleine Albright said that the man had Marfan syndrome. He was dead, and he had been dead, and he would be pulled out as an object of once we left Iraq.
Unbelievable.
So we didn't kill anybody. That narrative
Thanks a lot, Charles.
Such a ridiculous narrative. It was made into a movie, which was also ridiculous, Zero Dark 30. Mm-hmm. And Jose Gonzalez, who created that false narrative, had to, and also, by the way, leaked out covert secrets. He was the head of the CIA, Director of National Intelligence Operatives, literally gave the storyline to Catherine Bigelow and her co-partner.
Steve, do you have to go, or can you stay till the other side of this break, or do you need to go?
Yeah, I can stay.
All right, hang on. We'll be right back with some more of your calls. It's not fair to leave you on hold all this time. You don't get to talk to Dr. Steve Pacheco, so you will, and then the last hour is all yours. Okay? Okay. John Wells in for George Norrie tonight. Good to be here with you. Good to have you with us. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you very much. You know, as we go on through the evening, you might want to check out Dr. Steve Pacheco's websites, stevetalks.tv. Yes, stevetalks.tv. And then NBI Health. It's November Bravo India Health.com. NBI health.com. Check it out. Some more calls and some more Steve in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Hang on. Well, this is just a little news thing here. Two commuter trains serving New York City collided in Connecticut during this afternoon's evening rush hour, sending about 60 people to the hospital, including six with critical injuries, Governor Daniel Malloy said. About 250 people are on board the Metro North trains, one heading east from New York City's Grand Central Station to New Haven, derailed about 6:10 p.m. just outside Bridgeport, MTA and Bridgeport officials said. So if you're up in that part of the world, you wondered what that was. Well, that's what it was, and the route has been closed indefinitely. Don't know when it'll reopen. We're with Dr. Steve Pachenik right now, and just very quickly, Steve, because we've got. I don't want to drag you into a long one here, because a bunch of people still want to talk to you. But you know, if that Osama bin Laden thing was a staged event, then do you have any thoughts? And if you don't, it's perfectly okay. I'm not trying to pull you into one of those jackpots, but what do you make of all these? These shootings like Aurora, and then this thing at Sandy Hook, and then this marathon bomb, where the last thing I heard about is that one of the two brothers that was captured in the boat had scrawled his bye-bye message on the inside of the cabin with a Marxalot that I guess he found lying around there, you know, admitting that he had done this and his ties to that and so forth. It just seemed like, oh, really? He left a note?
Well, yeah. But let me just quickly state this. Aurora was very definitely a massacre, which was committed by a person who was not mentally incompetent. I was indirectly involved in just making that determination. As for Sandy Hook, that was a false flag. I can understand that. That was totally a false narrative. It didn't occur. There was no Asperger's individual. There was no mother who created a kid who gave her guns, and she was an alcoholic, and he came in and shot 33 PS students plus six more in 3.5 minutes, all kinds of shots. It's just not possible. The narrative made no sense, and now they've taken down the school, and they paid $63 million, and the state of Connecticut knows very well this was not even in existence, and Obama lied. I mean, that's why I continuously say the man's a pathological liar. As for the last Boston massacre, I really indict Mueller, the FBI, and really go back to the CIA. When you hear anything about Chechens coming to the United States with Uzbekis, that has to do with consular officers overseas, U.S. Foreign Service consular officers who are usually covered by the CIA, and that usually deals with the CIA operatives who are involved in either Chechnya, Dagestan, or Central Asian Republic. And was a total a mess up by the FBI, the CIA, and there were lies there. So again, what happens is the lie, the pathology, the corruption, the distortion continues from Osama bin Laden to Sandy Hook to Boston Massacre. And the government keeps on repeating its narratives that are false, inconsistent, and finally they get caught. You know, it's like the bank robber. When John Dillinger was caught by the FBI, they said to him, well, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. Well, right. This president keeps on creating lies, distortions, and occasions for conundrums and fights because that's all he knows. That's what he's continuously doing on behalf of the military-industrial complex. Now, let's make that very clear. That's a huge military complex with a military that is overblown, very dysfunctional, and really has to be taken down very seriously.
Gotcha. All right, so, let's grab another one real quick as we start, as we're turning into our depletium here. Mike in Livermore, California on Wild 5. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing great, John. How are you, John, Steve, or Doctor? Oh, what a wonderful show. You had mentioned earlier something, I may have heard it wrong, a scholarship or something from the CFR, which would be the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah. I
take it. Okay. What can you tell us about the influence of the Council on Foreign Relations on presidents going all the way back to, Nixon, Johnson, and its connection with the CIA?
I can tell you very much. I had left the council about a year ago because it was totally dysfunctional. In the early years, the council was created by the Rockefeller Foundation. It was created for the sole purpose to have a body of knowledge where officials, former or former officials and future officials would get together and discuss foreign policy. Most of our presidents were either involved in the Council on Foreign Relations, but its influence has really waned. There have been many councils and many think tanks. The RAND Corporation was influential 30 years ago. It's not now. A Council on Foreign Relations has a very large body of people that really is not influential. You have the American Enterprise Institute, where you have people like Paul Wolfowitz and others. That's far more influential. Heritage Foundation, where Jim DeMint is now the head of the ex-senator, that's very, very influential. The Brookings Institute, which is run by Stroh Talbot, that's very influential. So there are many think tanks that, in my opinion, are far more influential in the Washington, D.C. parties than the Council on Foreign Relations. It basically ended up to be a nursing home for those who have won a towel. Talk about old stories and old tales. I left. I mean, I didn't want to fund it. I didn't really get anything out of it. I think it's totally dysfunctional. In the earlier days, it had a purpose. It had a meaning. It was not the inner government, but it was more exclusive and more discreet in its knowledge and the base in which it culled individuals from. It gave me the opportunity to come in apolitically into both Republican and Democratic institutions. But as it evolved, like most institutions, it became dysfunctional and disorganized and really not relevant.
Gotcha. Hey, Phyllis on wildcard line number one in Aurora, Colorado. Welcome, Phyllis.
Welcome.
Phyllis.
Well, I'm not Phyllis, but I'll be as far as you want.
You don't sound like a Phyllis. Good grief.
But Steve, I can go along with your false narrative on the Osama thing, because with that helicopter being taken out with the SEALs over Afghanistan to silence maybe some of the people who were really SEALs then, that makes you wonder. But I cannot, because I've got a CIA, a retired CIA and his friend from Schreiber Air Force Base in NORAD, and a current, I won't say what that one is, at the CIA Computer Center here in Denver. Both of them say, no way, Obama CIA, Communist Party, Steve, that the whole thing about Business International Company, it wasn't a CIA front like his one guy put out there on the internet. It was a Communist Party front. Frank Marshall Davis, Communist Party USA. Who supports Obama? Look at Robert Bauer, his chief attorney with Perkins Coie LLP. Devoted communist and his wife, Anita, who loves Mao. There's no way this guy's CIA, Steve.
Well, okay, I'm not going to argue the point, but you just go back to his mother, who was CIA, his grandmother, who was CIA and grandfather. I just make the case. I think you have a point, but I can't argue the point at this point. I'm just telling you that his teachers at Occidental, if you look at them very carefully, I don't want to name them right here, they were ex-CIA. Operatives, and they're well known in the covert community. It's not a positive or negative. It's simply a point of fact that he went to Occidental in Los Angeles, and you can look it up, and you'll see who his teachers are, and they are CIA operatives. It wasn't a secret. So you may have a point, whatever your friends have said, but truthfully, that's not the case.
Roger on the international line. Let's bring him on from Toronto, Canada. Roger.
Hi, everyone. Doctor, I was just wondering what your assessment is of the Jimmy Carter presidency, because his reputation seems to be getting better as time goes on.
That's an excellent question. You know, while I was there, I was not enamored of Jimmy Carter because he was a strong micromanager. But truthfully, as the years gone by, he's done a lot. I mean, number one, he really initiated the Camp David Accords. No one deserves more credit than Jimmy Carter. So I have no idea why the present presidents don't ask him for that assistance. Number two, he did fire over 4,000 CIA operatives correctly saying we don't need them and what we have are political officers. Number three, he did initiate human rights. At the time when it started with Pat Darien and Harding Carter, even I was a little bit confused to the effect that it would have on the foreign policy, but only in retrospect, years later, did that become a very essential element in the takedown of the Soviet Union, and Bill Gates, the DCI, Director of Central Intelligence Agency, also agreed. I would consider Jimmy Carter, despite some lapses on the Iran hostage and the domestic policy of where the interest rates went up to 80, 90%, one of our greater presidents in the past 30 years. I agree with that.
Very interesting.
I know it's bizarre, but at the time when I worked with him, I didn't feel that, and I resigned. But in years later, when I look back, I said, this is a man who had a strategic vision, had tactical capability, and though he was a micromanager, really was able to accomplish quite a lot in the few years he was there, and he came out of nowhere and had conviction, and he still does. So I have to objectively say that he was quite effective. I would say that Bush Sr. was very effective in foreign policy. For example, he took down apartheid, never said a word. He really was instrumental in implementing the Reagan Doctrine on the Soviet Union. He was exceedingly effective. He took down East and West Germany, Berlin. He was the one who did that. He took down many of the Central American elements. He had other issues, but in many ways, he is far better in foreign policy than anybody gives him credit for. Certainly better than his sons, and certainly better than his successors, Clinton, Bush Jr., or Obama.
Gotcha.
And so, he is quiet. He doesn't say a word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. First time caller, Wendell in Blountville, Tennessee. How are you?
Hello, Mr. Wales. Hello, Doctor. Thank you for taking my call. Greetings from the home state of Harrod Baker. My question would be a simple one. I would want you to ask first, which you've explained a lot of, but what is your agenda, if you have one, and could you explain it maybe in the terms that the common man would understand? And two, did I understand you to say that Sandy Hook was not real and there was not children killed at Sandy Hook?
That nobody was killed. It was a totally false narrative. But let me go back to my agenda. My agenda is very simple. I served our country as both a military officer and a senior official in the State Department, but I really left to become an entrepreneur and a physician. My agenda was very simple. I just wanted to be an American who stood up and said, look, this 9/11 is false. We've killed our own people, and we're going to create more disasters and self-destructive elements. And my agenda is very simple, to stop our government from self-destructiveness and imploding and having this country implode within. We don't have foreign enemies. We weren't attacked from abroad. The only enemies we have is our debt and our resources that are being utilized for war. We don't need an army that big. We don't need 2.2 million. We don't need a CIA that's out of control. I don't need 16 intelligence agencies that are dysfunctional. I don't need an IRS that's dysfunctional. So my agenda is very simple. I'm an American citizen. I stood up as an American citizen. I was formally brought to charges on treason as an American citizen because I worked against George Bush Jr. and I said he has to go for what he did. But I'm more than happy to stand up again and say, look, this is enough. As an American citizen, I will fight every effort the government makes to repress me, suppress me. That's it. As simple as that. I'm an everyman guy. I am as simple as that. I have to work every day. I have to be accountable. Nobody's ever given me money. I was asked to be promoted to Brigadier General. I refused. I didn't receive a pension from the government. And I have my own businesses. That's all I am.
Just sounds pretty good. It's enough to keep you busy. All right, we've got time for one more. That's going to be Renee in Tucson, Arizona. Renee, are you there?
For taking my call, Mr. Wells, and hello to Dr. Steve. My question is, Dr. Steve, do you think that, as they did in Russia, the psychiatric community in league with the pharmaceutical companies are being used on political dissidents as the a way of shutting them up?
Well, let me get it. What I want to say is, no, I don't think we use the pharmaceutical industry and psychiatry in the way Russia did to deal with political dissidents. But I do believe that my psychiatric profession has to examine itself, particularly with the forthcoming book that's called The Diagnostic Statistical Manual 5, where they've created all kinds of labels and diagnoses that don't exist, and they were criticized correctly by the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, saying, guys, this is not a consensus of people who are working for these drug companies, but you need more scientific evidence. So I am critical of my own field, psychiatry, to say we're out of control and that we need more science and less diagnostic criteria for making money. But we're not using it for dissidents. We're not capable. We don't know it. That's not an issue here. What's an issue is that we have a dysfunctional psychiatric system and a dysfunctional pharmaceutical industry that's making a fortune and creating drugs that are not well understood, but we're not using it for political purposes.
You know, I was just curious. Earlier, you mentioned Mr. Gonzalez. Did you mean Rodriguez?
I'm sorry. You were right.
No. That's all right.
No, you're right.
No, I'm just keeping you covered. That's all.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
No worries. Well, I'll tell you what. We're down to 2 minutes. So leave the world with whatever you would like to leave it with.
Well, I want to leave it with an optimistic note. We're in America, and I see a very, very happy future for us. Whatever, as John said very correctly, dawn is approaching. Light is here. We're a very vibrant country where we make mistakes, and that's the beauty of our country. Our country is not based on success only. It's based on the fact that I can have a failure, you can have a failure. But tomorrow is always the promise of America, that tomorrow we can do better for ourselves, we can do better for our country. And if we take care of ourselves and we take back the powers that were taken from us in the government, that is, you know, tell the IRS that's enough, tell the TSA, we don't need you. Tell the military, we don't need 2.2 million people. Tell our president that you don't need the limousines and the Secret Service. And we go back to the regional basis, less government, more employment, better education, better schools, better treatment for our veterans. We're going to do okay, but we're getting there. And it's not an easy road. As John has said, we're walking on thin ice, but I'm not sure we've ever had thick ice. And I don't see it as bad, what's happening to us. I see it as a point of struggle, which has been the history of America since its founding. We didn't have an easy birth, and we don't have an easy growing process. And so I want each and every one of you to think very positively that tomorrow's another day. You can do something about it. Listen to the issues, concentrate on them, share them with your friends. But you, as citizens of America, have to take responsibility for the actions of your own and the actions of our government. And once you protest, once you write, once you converse with your friends, this is a wonderful country, and God bless this country, and I see a wonderful future.
Excellent. It's been a most enjoyable evening with you, Dr. Steve Pachenik. Come back again soon, and we'll check in with you from time to time and make sure that you do. All righty then. There's a mellow little interlude for you as we approach the fourth hour, which will be comprised entirely of your calls. Naked Lines on Coast to Coast AM.